He is one of the most accomplished and recognized journalists in America today. An Emmy Award recipient, Juan Williams is an author, an op-ed writer, TV commentator, a former White House correspondent who in his career has been affiliated with PBS, NPR, Fox, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Ebony, Time Magazine, GQ, ABC, and perhaps most of all, he's been on The Oprah Winfrey Show. In 1988, he wrote the seminal and prize-winning book Eyes on the Prize about the civil rights movement from 1954 to 1965, accompanied by the notable PBS documentary of the same name. He's written a new book called New Prize for These Eyes, which was hit the bookstores just several weeks ago, about the rise of America's second civil rights movement. Juan, welcome to All Things Soul at WBGO.
No, this is a treat for me, but I don't even know how to address you because I know you as Secretary Johnson and someone I greatly admire, by the way.
Well, thank you very much.
But I don't. So what should I call you? Should I call you DJ, Mr. Secretary, Mr. Soul Music? What should I call you?
Whatever you, I'll tell you what I tell others. Whatever you're comfortable with, okay?
Okay.
But I've begun to read your book, the new book, but there's something on the book jacket that I think says a lot. More than a century of civil rights activism reached a mountaintop with the arrival of a Black man in the Oval Office, but hopes for a unified post-racial America were deflated when Barack Obama's presidency met with furious opposition. A white right-wing backlash was brewing, and a volcanic new movement, a second civil rights movement, began to erupt. Today's movement is dealing with new realities. Demographic change has placed progressive whites in a new role among the largest, youngest population of Blacks, Hispanics, and Asians in the nation's history. The new generation is social media savvy and has an agenda fueled by discontent with systemic racism and the persistent scourge of police brutality. Today's activists are making history in a new economic and cultural landscape, and they are using a new set of tools and strategies to do so. Juan, I could spend a week talking to you about this subject, and I'm not exactly sure how to begin. But one thing that I will remember about the post-George Floyd movement and activism that we saw was a photograph of someone wearing a T-shirt who was in a march or a demonstration, and the T-shirt said something like, "This is not your grandmother's civil rights movement." And so what do you think that statement meant? And well, I suspect the answer to this question is what's reflected in your book.
It is. Well, the whole notion is that there's a second movement taking place right now. And I tell you what I have to get over with a lot of people. I'm 70 years old, Mr. Secretary, and I got to tell you, there are a lot of people might just say, "Hey, why do you say there's a second movement? You know, like, where's the new Dr. King? What are you talking about?" I have to say, look, this is a second movement that's in fact having greater impact than the first movement. And there is no new Dr. King. First movement had things like the Great March on Washington, 1963, intended to get civil rights legislation through the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, 65. This movement, after George Floyd was killed, this movement had thousands of marches all over the United States, globally. I mean, you could have been in Paris, you could have been in London, Buenos Aires, and they're marching under a Black Lives Matter banner. And not only that, this is a movement that's viral 24/7. It's about messages going viral, images of, you know, George Floyd with the policeman on his neck going viral. This is a totally different, this is not your grandmother's civil rights movement. And, you know, you touched on something. I got to tell you, Barack Obama, when he spoke at the Democratic Convention, this would have been 2004 in Boston, he introduced this idea that we are not a Black America, a white America. We're not Asian America, Hispanic. We are the United States of America. But there was something really different about this, different than First Movement or even what came in between, in that he said, my story couldn't have happened in any other country but America. That he spoke optimistically. He spoke like a sunrise, like we're facing new horizons of potential for peaceful, unified racial progress in America, not about Black grievance, not about slavery, discrimination, ongoing bias. No, he was like, you know what? I want to be the advent of a new day. And then that started conversations about post-racial America. And to me, that is the start of trying to rethink who we are as a multiracial democracy in this country. But as you point out, there was a backlash. And the backlash starts with the Tea Party and opposition to the Affordable Care Act, then called Obamacare. And, oh, he's taken apart my health care to help those lower income or lower middle class people, disproportionately Black. Oh, he says he's just the president. No, he's the Black president. And of course, Donald Trump starts with the birther stuff. But to me, what you're seeing, and it goes on to this day, to George Floyd, to Trump, is a second distinct movement that has tremendous power. And I wish it had the music that you play. I mean, you know, you think back to the first music, you think of, you know, my favorite is Curtis Mayfield, you know, Curtis People Mayfield. Get Ready. You know,
Man, Oh Man.
Oh, terrific. You know, yep. I mean, that's awesome.
Played that on my last show.
Oh, okay. Right. Or you think of Sam Cooke, A Change Is Gonna Come, you know.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
And that's civil rights music, First Movement music. Today, I don't know what I would exactly point to that I would say is similar. But again,
it's probably music that you and I don't listen to, Juan.
That's right.
To the extent there is. Right.
Ignorance, my brother. Ignorance.
Right, right. Talking about the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, with the benefit of looking at it from an historical perspective, it was fundamentally a movement of Southern Blacks, and it had a strong Southern flavor to it. And you're right, Dr. King was the centerpiece. The Black church was the centerpiece of that movement, the Black church in the South. And the essential appeal to both white and Blacks is we want our share of the American dream and the American guarantees embodied in the Constitution. What about us? Treat us like everyone else. Right. And as you know, when Dr. King tried to take his message to the North, to cities like Chicago, New York, Detroit, often he was met with a great deal of resistance. And by the mid-late 60s, there was a more militant faction of the civil rights movement, not entirely hospitable to his message. Now, as you point out, there's no one leader of the current effort, and the essential appeal is not about a change in law, like, you know, pass a civil rights bill or pass a voting rights bill. And we all remember 2008 when Barack Obama was elected. I was there in Chicago. I had helped in his campaign. Mm-hmm. I thought to myself, I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime.
Right.
And in a strong sense, we all felt we're at the mountaintop. This is Dr. King's mountaintop. A Black man has been elected president. And he brought with him a Black attorney general, a Black secretary of Homeland Security. But racism didn't go away.
No.
Police brutality did not go away. Racial profiling did not go away with the election of a Black man who served honorably without blemish in the White House for 8 years. So where does that leave us? Where, I mean, there's still racism in America, but how did the election of a Black president for 8 years advance the cause, advance the dream. How do you see that?
Wow. Well, it's so rich. And the advantage.
It's a long question. Sorry.
No. I said it was so rich, Mr. Secretary, because you know so much. And so I, as the journalist in me, is like, wow, this guy knows what he's talking about. But here's the thing that you touched on. And there are a couple of things I just want to quickly go through. One is, I think a lot of young people in America, especially young Black people, who did not live through the first movement, are like, what are these old people talking about? All this progress, the right. Fruit of the entire first civil rights movement was the idea that you would have more Black elected officials, highly educated, capable people, and one day we would have Black mayors, Black senators, Black congresspeople, and a Black president. You picking up on what you said, Mr. Secretary? Ebony Magazine ran a cover. It said, in our lifetime. It's unbelievable to me that there was a Black president elected. It's like, wow, this is mind-blowing. But then for the younger generation, the question was, so what difference does it make? Is this Black president going to help me in a way that the other white presidents never did? And I think for a lot of young Black people, it was like, well, I still have bad schools in my neighborhood. There's still violence in my neighborhood. There's still tremendous income inequality in America.
There's still racial profiling in the police department.
Right. Yeah. Remember Stop and Frisk in New York was going on. Mm-hmm. And of course, then Trayvon Martin happens. And that's the moment when the jury acquits the man who killed him, that people said Black Lives Matter. This kid might be walking around in a hoodie. He might look, you know, why is he walking in the rain? He's got the cell phone going, you know. But why did you kill this guy? He was unarmed. He wasn't doing anything. He's coming from the corner store, you know, with Skittles. What are you talking about? And then that starts a whole major effort, Black Lives Matter. So that picks up on what you're talking about. Now, you say to me, what difference did it make to have Barack Obama in the White House? I think historically, there's no getting away from that as a brass tack moment, not just in Black American, in American history. And he has to deal not only with issues of race. Remember when Trayvon was killed, just to pick up and continue there. And he said, if I had a son, he would have looked like Trayvon.
Right.
When Henry Louis Gates was arrested by a cop trying to get into his own house after a trip, he'd lost his key. He was trying to figure out how to get in, and the police show up and, what are you doing? Who are you trying to, who's, and he says, it's my house. I'm trying to get in my house. And the president, President Obama, said, well, that's stupid. Why would you arrest a guy trying to get into his own house? And the people immediately said, especially the white opposition, said he took the side of the Black man over the white cop.
Right.
And his approval rating among white Americans never again got above 50%. So you understand that he was dealing with race, even as he was saying, I'm not the Black president. I'm not the post-racial president. I'm just president of the United States. Race was a constant factor in how people perceive Barack Obama.
Right.
And when you say to me, well, so where does that leave us now? I think one of the consequences of, what is the right word? Resentment, opposition, backlash, is Donald Trump. That Trump, yep, in a way, is an outgrowth of the first Black president. And I think it's hard to deal with. Remember, the first Black president's vice president then comes on the scene and defeats Trump. Now Trump is back. And what is he doing? He's trying to undo everything that Obama stood for, everything that Biden tried to pursue in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion, affirmative action. He's saying, you know what? People marching through the Capitol with a Confederate flag, they should be pardoned. This is unbelievable.
Yeah. So I was being interviewed once shortly after George Floyd's death. And the questioner, toward the end of the interview, asked me a question and I couldn't answer neatly in 5 seconds, which was, do you believe Donald Trump was a reaction to Barack Obama? And I didn't know how to answer that. I certainly did not want to say and don't believe that somehow something Barack Obama did brought on Donald Trump. But we do know from history that very often every action is followed by an equal and opposite reaction.
Right.
Every step forward very often is met by a step backward. Following Reconstruction, we had Jim Crow.
I was thinking the same thing.
World War I, we had a period of isolationism. Following World War II, we had the paranoia of the McCarthy era. Mm-hmm. Following the Civil Rights Movement, we had Richard Nixon's Law and Order.
Yeah.
And so very often, one step forward is met with a step backward. I wonder whether the step backward we appear to be in terms of racial progress, is a permanent readjustment or is it temporary? When you look at the larger picture, Juan, how do you see the journey toward a more perfect union, so to speak?
Well, you know, we started out talking about Curtis Mayfield, People Get Ready, right? There's a train a coming. And to me, the train is coming. It's just, you know, this train comes, it goes. It's not that you missed anything if you didn't get on board, but you better get ready for the next train. And right now, there are a lot of people who are in sympathy with the idea of racial justice, who feel, wow, I missed the train because there's Trump again and he's steaming ahead. I feel mm-hmm. defeated. I feel left out, like I'm standing on the platform watching the train go off with the MAGA crowd. And my saying to you is, there's always another train coming. And I think that's what you were suggesting, Mr. Secretary, that history is like a pendulum. You go one way, you come back the other way. But time never stops. The pendulum keeps swinging. And right. The thing about the despair of this moment is that people might think, well, I can't take it. I'm not going to watch the news. I want to walk away. I'm in distress. But I would say to the contrary, count on time and the train that's coming and get ready, because you got to continue to keep your eyes on the prize, or in my the title of my new book, you know, new prize for these eyes. So there's another train coming and we got to help create the moment for that train. And, you know, I really sometimes am, I hope I'm not naive or Cinderella, you know, with the person with the pink sunglasses or whatever. Mm-hmm. But when I think back to George Floyd, I remember that the approval rating for Black Lives Matter after that happened, when there were at least thousands of marches with millions of people, 60%+ of white America said, yes, you know, in terms of racial justice and racial progress, we speak as one. 70% of Latinos and Blacks agreed. We right. speak as one. Now, the numbers, the approval for something like Black Lives Matter has gone down. It's now about 50% still, but it's gone down. But guess what? It seems to me that those people still believe in the tenets of a mixed America, and it's more mixed than ever. First movement was it was like 90% white, 10% Black. Now it's 60% white, it's 13% Black, but the biggest minority is Latino, and Asians are the fastest growing minority. This right. is a demographic mix. And I think there are lots of people like you, Mr. Secretary, who think, well, of course we believe in justice and equity and fair play and a level playing field. We're not gone. We're not defeated. We are good people, and we stand for what is right, and we can see what's wrong, but we believe in what's right. I don't think we're going away, and I think there's a train coming.
Let me ask you a tough question then. What do you think accounts for some of the Black vote drifting toward Donald Trump and the Republican Party?
Sure. I mean, that's a very important question, because what did you see? About, I think it's like 25% of young Black men voted for Trump. 50% of Latino men voted for Trump. Maybe most stunningly, given the abortion issue, white women voted for Trump.
Right.
I mean, that's stunning. But anyway, the answer, I think, is there was a general discontent with the status quo. And, you know, to me, one of the problems with Kamala Harris's campaign was she was about maintaining, stabilizing America and saying, I am not this wild fascist, is what she said, Donald Trump. But where was her picking up on the energy of this second civil rights movement and offering a vision for this is where I'm going to take you? I want to take you places, you know, to pick up on that song, you know, let me take you there. I'll take you there. Yeah, people didn't feel it. They saw it. She's just going to keep us here. And I think a lot of younger people, but especially to your point, young Black men and young Latino men were like, well, I don't see that our neighborhoods are so great after Barack Obama, after Joe Biden. I don't see that the schools are better. I don't see that mass incarceration is going. I don't see that police harassment has stopped. You know, I think things are just, you know, I see inflation. And they were like, well, yeah, he may have a racial problem, Trump, but if he's going, he says he wants to shake things up. Plus, he's got all these women and gold signs with his name on it. And, you know, he's always boasting about something. And he says that we are involved with identity politics and radical left wing nonsense and transgender people getting surgery. I think they bought into that nonsense. They were distracted, in my opinion. You ask my opinion, that's my opinion. They fell for the okie doke.
This second civil rights movement you write about in your book, how do you see the tactics of this movement to the extent it is a unified movement? How do you see the tactics differing from the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s?
Well, first of all, it's not unified. I think a lot of it is online. Everyone has a voice. You see lots of people with different opinions. Right. And the people who created Black Lives Matter were disdainful of the idea of the leadership structure in the first civil rights movement, which, as we have talked about, featured Dr. King, but also people like A. Philip Randolph, Whitney Young, Roy Wilkins. They saw that as patriarchy. You know, men leading everything, and a lot of them leading it from New York in big buildings and saying, here's the agenda. And they said, right. No, if you're in St. Louis and Ferguson, where Michael Brown was killed, or if you are in, you know, Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed, I could go on. You decide what's the racial agenda for your community. What are the racial needs in your area? And you can call yourselves Black Lives Matter and be chapters, et cetera. So it became diffuse. And with it came some of the financial problems that we referenced earlier, but also a lack of a consistent agenda. So the first movement's agenda was about the legislation, the Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, fair housing, et cetera. Now you come into a period where people say, well, is it about police? Is it about stopping police violence against people of color? And they say, what about mass incarceration, disproportionate right. number of Black men in jail? What about the schools? What about arguments about affirmative action in colleges and universities and hiring? I tell you what is even interesting is, what about the telling of Black history in America's curriculum in schools? And a lot of people say, oh, don't do that. You're going to make the kids feel bad if you start right. talking about lynching and discrimination and bigotry. I think now the agenda is more diffuse. It's right. not to say that it's weaker, because I think it affects more people. And even as I am speaking to you, Mr. Secretary, you know that Donald Trump is right now going after this diversity, equity, inclusion thing, throwing out things that happened in the 1960s. 11246.
He's saying DEI officials don't even come to work.
That's what I'm so, yeah. you know, it's, I mean, in a way, I don't wish this on us, but it's a clear example right now that there is the opposition is there. They're fighting. And some way say they're in office, they're winning. But people, you got to fight back. People get ready.
People get ready. Have a train a car. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
What did you learn in doing the research and writing of this book that was new to you, that you did not know but had a full appreciation for after writing this book?
You know, a couple things. One is, you know, I think one of the benefits of being a writer is that you get to learn. So if I talk to Jay Johnson, I get the opportunity to learn from you.
I think you did talk to me at one point about this book.
I did.
You interviewed me, yes.
And but I was thinking back even when you were Homeland Secretary. I remember coming to visit you and riding with you actually to the White House. It's a wonderful memory. You were very kind to me. Thank you. But, you know, you get to learn from smart people. And one of the things about learning as a writer is your editor will say, where'd you get that? Is that right? And one of those moments came up. Editor said to me, it says here in your text that white Americans have not voted for a Democrat to be president of the United States since 1964. That's crazy. Where'd you get that? And I was like, no, it's not. It's a fact. And so I had to go and, you know, back into the numbers and the research and show that's right. True. That hasn't happened. I think lots right. of people would reject that out of hand and just say, that can't be true. You mean, didn't vote for Clinton, didn't vote for Obama?
Right. The Democratic presidential candidates right. lose the white vote.
Ever right. since the passage of the Civil Rights Act by right. Lyndon Baines Johnson. The second thing to say to you is more of a personal surprise. In the start of the book, I talk about Ferguson and what happens, you know, the Black Lives Matter on the ground. And you see a president, Barack Obama, black man, in a unique position because no other president was black. So now you have race riots basically going on. And the White House has asked, should we send the first black president? Can he be a healing force in terms of what's going on in the streets there? And ultimately they decide against it. But the idea is, oh, he plays such a unique role. And going forward, what you see is a lot of the people who think of themselves as young, progressive people of color are disappointed with Obama in a way that I hadn't appreciated, Mr. Secretary, because I don't want you to think badly of me as a journalist, but I think Obama's pretty great president, you know? I just, mm-hmm. If you ask me for my bottom line, I think, wow, that guy made history and I support and yeah, anyway. And, but when I was doing the research, what I came to understand is there are a lot of people who saw him as black people as disappointing.
Juan, in the course of interviewing people for your book and meeting people involved in activism today, who are the one or two people that really stand out in your mind as extraordinarily impressive leaders and really to you were extraordinary? Does anyone come to mind?
Well, so you're excluding yourself and people in our age range and people who are involved with the Obama administration?
Yes, I'm talking about, you know, somebody of my kids' generation and your kids' generation.
Okay.
Who are out there in the streets, who are activists, who are pressuring our leaders to do better, you know, in their 20s and 30s.
So, you know, I don't know exactly. I don't remember exactly how old Stacey Abrams is, the woman down in Georgia who was a member of the state legislature.
Sure, Stacey Abrams. Sure.
And now involved to this moment in efforts to combat voter suppression. I think Stacey Abrams really is a standout character of this generation.
Right.
Second movement, as I describe it in New Prize for These Eyes. But there are also people involved. And I got to say, again, people just don't know these people, but there are people at an organization called Color of Change who've been involved in trying to get corporate America to do a better job of diversifying not only their message, but in terms of hiring, promotion, all that kind of stuff. And then you have people who are involved at a lot of these civil rights organizations, you know, places like Southern Poverty Law Center, you know.
Right, Stevenson, right.
That's exactly where I was going, you know, that, you know, if you look at Bryan Stevenson has created a fabulous, inspiring new museum.
Equal justice, yeah.
Yeah. So to me, you could talk about people like that, but I think it's a bit distracting because it sounds like we're searching for another Dr. King, and maybe one's coming. I don't know. But I would say right now, the style of leadership is not that. It's not the one leader with a consistent agenda who is available to the press to make a statement. It's right. a conversation that's very much online. Remember that whole concept, a new concept to me when it emerged, Black Twitter, you know, Black people having conversations, but it goes beyond that now. All the podcasts, the streaming, and people talking, and what are they experiencing? Remember that guy who was a bird watcher in Central Park?
Yes.
And he pulls out the phone and he is like, this lady is saying she's going to call the cops because I'm black, but I'm just telling her I wasn't threatened. I'm telling her that she shouldn't have her dog out here scaring away these birds. And people are like, wow, that's a hell of a story. That's what living as a black person is like in America. And people said, that's part of this movement. So, Mr. Secretary, again, that's hard to, is that guy a civil rights activist leader? I don't think so, but his example, and in that moment, had real power. And I would, one other thing to say on this is, do you know progressive white America is very important in this second movement? You think about the power of progressive whites, and here I'm talking about most often people who are college educated, and their belief in continuing to do repair on the racial division in America. They are a key component of Black Lives Matter. And to me, when I look at them, again, I don't necessarily say, oh, there's a white leader coming for the second or third movement.
Right.
But it's potentially there. And you look now at the political leadership. You look in Congress. You look at someone like AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You look at some of these younger people. Again, they're politicians. You know, is Senator Booker in New Jersey an activist? No, I think he's a politician. How about our old friend Bernie Sanders? Is he an activist or a politician? But right. The politics are going to play a very big role in getting the pendulum to swing back. You got to win elections. You got to be serious about politics. And I think maybe we're starting to see some of those younger politicians in more of an activist role.
Right, right. We talked about steps forward, steps backward. In reaction to a step forward, there's sometimes a step backward. I'm going to read to you one of my favorite quotes from a president. This was from Franklin Roosevelt, his final inaugural address in 1945, just before he died. This was after the war, or just before the end of the war. And he said this, and I believe this, and I want to get your reaction to this. This is a quote from President Roosevelt. Sometimes we will be rising to the heights. Then all will seem to reverse itself and start downward. The great fact to remember is that the trend of civilization itself is forever upward, that a line drawn between the middle of the peaks and the valleys of the centuries always has an upward trend. Juan, what is your reaction to that statement?
Praise the Lord. I mean, I think it's inspiring because it just tells you, you know, you keep your eyes on the prize, keep looking up. And if you follow even economics, investment, they'll tell you the stock market is a good bet. Why? Keeps going up. May for a moment have a downward trend. You may start, oh my God, no, keeps going up. You look at what's happened in terms of race relations in America, you say, keeps going up. You say, wait a second. I remember when they were calling Irish people dogs. I remember when they said Italians weren't welcome. I remember when Jews were excluded, when we wouldn't even welcome Jews into the United States. And it keeps going up. I remember when we'd never had a Catholic as president. Oh, but it keeps going up. And I remember we had never had a Jay Johnson. We never had a Barack Obama. We had never, ever come close to that reality. Keep going on. Keep going up. So, you know, a silly guy, an optimist without reason at this moment of Donald Trump in the White House. I'll let you make the call. Feel free. But I am in line with what FDR said, that if you look at the line of history, there's no question. We keep going up.
Juan, thank you very much for your words of wisdom and inspiration today. Good luck with the sale of your new book. The book is New Prize for These Eyes. I hope everyone will take a moment to read this terrific book written by a terrific American. Juan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Secretary. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.